You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Moriarty has tried to kill him many times. Arthur Conan Doyle finished him off once, but Sherlock Holmes keeps coming back again and again.
More recently, the estate of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle lost a copyright case with a judge ruling that Holmes and Dr. Watson are now in the public domain.
Laura Miller joins us now. She's co-founder and staff writer at Salon.com. She recently wrote the piece, A Study in Sherlock, for Harper's Magazine. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to Sherlock in the public domain, let's talk about what makes this character so appealing that he keeps coming back and being reinvented again and again.
Well, it is a little bit of a mystery. I think that every generation sees something that it craves in Holmes. Of course, there's his incredible deductive powers that seem almost like a magical skill, but then can be, you know, the lid can be ripped off and he shows Watson or whoever else happens to be around that it's all perfectly rational. So it's a way of sort of making the advanced technological society that we live in and science and rationality seem less mysterious. But there's also the incredibly close relationship between him and Watson, and there is something very powerful about that bond that in many ways is the core of the stories. And of course, they're just like great campy fun. So it kind of depends on what you're looking for, and I think that's the secret of any really long-lived character or story is that it meets all kinds of needs.
Well, in a way, he seems like such a product of England, but he's had a worldwide appeal. We love him here in the United States, that's for sure. So why does he translate to our time and our place?
Yeah, that is a difficult... you're asking me to put my fingers on kind of a mystery here, but I think that there is a particular charm to the era of England that he lived in. The late Victorian era, of course, it wasn't like the real late Victorian era. It's like a fantasia of that time period in the same way that, say, The Lord of the Rings offers a sort of fantasia of medieval British rural life. You know, it's a whole world. It's very extensive, though, and it's a kind of an alternate reality that people can enter into. There are these hardcore Sherlockian fan clubs where everyone gets the name of a minor character and people dress up in costumes. And there's something about that kind of world building that certain fan bases really respond to. And I think that's another part of the appeal. You can just immerse yourself in Sherlockiana.
You write about the court case that led to the character and his colleagues being put in the public domain in the U.S. outside of the control of the Arthur Conan Doyle estate. What does that mean for the future of the character?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing because the copyright status of Sherlock Holmes is kind of ambiguous. I mean, he's in the public domain in the U.K. already, or he was before this finding. You know, in the short term, it means that when someone wants to do an anthology of sort of Sherlock Holmes spin-off stories, which is who the other party in this case was an editor who wanted to do that, they don't have to pay a fee to the estate. People can do adaptations, spin-offs, stories about minor characters from the main canon of Sherlock Holmes. All of this stuff, they can do this without worrying that they're violating a copyright. But that's not to say that people haven't already been doing that for years.
Now, this kind of thing hasn't always succeeded in the courts. Not that long ago, there was a Gone with the Wind sequel that was shut down because it didn't pass muster legally. Why did this one get over the gate?
It just aged out. Gone with the Wind was published, I believe, sometime in the 1930s. And depending on the work and depending on the publication date, it's usually around 75 years that the original creator or his or her heirs owns the rights. The Margaret Mitchell estate successfully argued that, or no, actually, they didn't successfully argue because Wind Undone, the book you're talking about, was eventually published. It was not withdrawn as a, it was as a parody or satire, which is legal, a legal use of the source material. But it came to court to begin with because the Margaret Mitchell estate still owned the rights to that. What was being decided was not whether these works were derivative, because they clearly were derivative of the Sherlock Holmes stories. It was whether the Conan Doyle estate still retained the rights to the character.
Well, you quote the editor of the volume of Sherlock Holmes stories in question saying, quote, "Sherlock Holmes belongs to the world now." Does he?
Absolutely. I think that when I wrote that piece, it was partly about the original stories, but it was also about the different ways that Holmes and Watson have been portrayed on the stage, in films, on television, in sort of fan fiction, and in stories that sort of, you know, imagine Holmes's adventures as an old man, or things that happened while he was on his great hiatus, the period when everyone thought that he was dead and he had all of these adventures. You know, there have been these sort of expose type stories, like a very famous and successful book called The 7% Solution, published in the 70s by Nicholas Meyer, which was about Sherlock Holmes's cocaine addiction, and posited that Watson always claimed that he had sort of weaned Holmes of his drug use, and so Meyer imagined that he took him to Vienna and had him treated by Sigmund Freud, who you know, unearthed the truth about Professor Moriarty not actually being a supervillain, and so these are these kind of, you know, that was an era. The 70s was an era when psychotherapy was just all the rage, and so he was therapized. Today's Sherlock Holmeses tend to be people who are maybe on the autism spectrum. You know, they're not not only can they not be, quote, cured, unquote, but they don't even necessarily want to be. They see their oddness or their, you know, unusual personalities as a strength rather than an illness.
I want to look at a couple of the most popular dramatic TV presentations of Sherlock Holmes over the last couple of generations. Let's start in the 80s with Jeremy Brett, a series I watched at the time and I know a lot of people loved. Let's give a listen to Jeremy Brett as Sherlock Holmes.
Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation. That is why I've chosen my own profession, or rather, created it, for I am the only one in the world.
And for a lot of people, he was the only Sherlock Holmes in the world, Jeremy Brett. Laura, what did you make of that rendition of Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, so great. I think he really is the gold standard of Sherlock Holmes. And people who are curious about that, I think you can still find a lot of those episodes on YouTube. The thing about Jeremy Brett was that the actor himself was manic depressive. And part of his characterization of Holmes, which famously consumed him in his autobiography, wrote about how he, you know, had that classic actor's dilemma of becoming completely entangled with the character. You know, part of his characterization, his understanding of Holmes, was in that perfectly chosen clip that you just played, the mental exaltation and then of being on a case, and then the dull routine of just ordinary life that Holmes couldn't endure, and so he had to take drugs to medicate it away. I mean, that was the essence of Brett's depiction of Holmes.
It's interesting when you contrast, you know, how beloved Holmes is today as a character in fiction and in film. with how little Sir Arthur Conan Doyle seemed to like him. Didn't he sort of say, I don't care what you do with him, kill him off, whatever, I don't care, he's not high art.
Yeah, Conan Doyle wanted to do was write this kind of very high-flown moral historical fiction, sort of like Sir Walter Scott, I think, would be his role model. And not a whole lot of people read Sir Walter Scott anymore these days, but, you know, when Conan Doyle was growing up, he was really kind of the, you know, a novelist that everyone... He was hugely popular, and everyone admired him. And so he kind of cranked out these Holmes stories. They're really inconsistent. I mean, Watson's wound is sometime in his leg and sometime in his shoulder. No one knows what his wife's name is or what if she's died. Or, you know, they were inconsistent because they kind of slapdash because they didn't really matter that much to Conan Doyle. He did not think... He was a little bit like, there was this whole thing in the 70s and 80s of how Woody Allen wanted to make these serious sort of Ingmar Bergman-style movies, but everyone wanted him to make comedies. And he complained that he was, you know, constantly being forced to make these goofy comedies when he wanted to make these serious art films. And Conan Doyle was in a similar position.
We're talking about The Many Lives of Sherlock Holmes with Laura Miller of Salon.com, looking at a fictional character who's been reinvented again and again. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about Sherlock Holmes now and the ways he's been reinvented over the years on books, on TV, and in the movies.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? What is your favorite version? Maybe one of the TV renditions, a movie, a favorite story, a tribute to Sherlock Holmes? Or is there one that you think really got it wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to take a listen to another clip. This is of a different rendition of Sherlock Holmes. This is Benedict Cumberbatch's version. Wow, it's hard to say, isn't it? This is a version that lots of people are literally and figuratively in love with. Here is Benedict Cumberbatch as Sherlock.
Oh, John, I envy you so much.
You envy me?
Your mind, so placid, straightforward, barely used. Mine's like an engine racing out of control. A rocket tearing itself to pieces, trapped on the launch pad. I need a case!
You've just solved one by harpooning a dead pig, apparently.
That was this morning.
I have to say, I'm a Sherlock fan. What do you think of that version, Laura?
I really like the new Sherlock. I like the way that it's set in the modern day London. I like the way that contemporary technology is incorporated and new sort of filmmaking techniques are used. I think that the sort of arch tone of it is actually perfectly compatible with the original stories, but a lot of people feel differently.
What do you make of some of the ways they use that technology? Dr. Watson is blogging about Holmes instead of writing stories about him. And texting, we see the texts as they're sent back and forth, and that makes a difference. That doesn't interfere with the story for you?
Well, no. You know, the thing about Sherlock Holmes is that because he belongs to everybody, there are ways that the character can be added to that only increase your enjoyment. I mean, we know that if Sherlock Holmes were alive today, of course he would text all the time because it's intrusive. You get to sort of say, what I have to say to you is so important, you have to pay attention to it right now, at the same time that it's kind of antisocial. You don't actually have to see or speak to the person. He broadcasts messages to large groups of people, but they can't respond to. I mean, there are just all these techniques that the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock uses, whether it's texting or passwords or any of these other technological devices that are part of our lives or technological practices. You know, he uses them in a way that is perfectly consistent with the original character. And because we know that character so well, there's something really delightful about seeing this adaptation.
And you said that some people have a problem with it. What are the criticisms you've heard leveled against the new version of Sherlock?
Oh, I think some people probably think that the tone is a little bit too campy, or they just don't like the actors, Cumberbatch in particular. They feel it's too stylized. They like a more sort of serious and straightforward Holmes, but I just think that the originals were so kind of campy in their own right, and I think deliberately so, that that I just can't really subscribe to that myself.
Talking to Laura Miller of Salon.com about Sherlock Holmes. Go to our callers now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We've got Deborah on the line in Milwaukee. Deborah, hi.
Hi. My favorite was Jeremy Brett, and I used to see him frequently on PBS, but they don't show it quite as much as I used to, but I bought a VHS like 10 years ago or longer when my son was young, and there was a Sherlock Holmes animated version, and it was animals that were the characters, dogs, and Holmes, in one point of the VHS or the movie, he'd say, "I can't see through all the shrubbery," and so when my son would then like remember that, and he would call things shrubbery, and he said, "I got that from that Sherlock Holmes movie you bought," and so I always think of that now whenever I see shrubbery.
Deborah, thank you so much for sharing that. That's a great story. Well, Sherlock Holmes, in addition to being a cartoon dog, he's been played for comedy by John Cleese. He's fought Nazis and I think vampires in fiction. People can do anything with him, can't they, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the qualities of a sort of great pop culture myth, because that's really what he has become. You know, he's become like Brer Rabbit or, the Jack character from Fairy Tales. He has all different kinds of adventures. He's always recognizably the same character, even though sometimes these depictions are really, really different. And he can be put into all different kinds of stories. And it's a kind of testimony to how sort of eternal and how constantly changing he is.
Wasn't there some sort of deliberate smudging about whether Sherlock Holmes was fact or fiction for a while?
Well, he was based on a real person, a medical professor who Conan Doyle studied. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a physician. But the original Sherlock Holmes fandom, which was really the first modern fandom, was kind of sprang out of a game that was eventually called The Great Game that Sherlock Holmes fans would play together, where they would try to make up explanations for the inconsistencies in the stories, and they would come up with these elaborate theories, and then they kind of spun off from that so that, certain characters from other writers would be like the secret love child of Sherlock Holmes and Irene Adler, or just all kinds of wild stuff that they would write these academic or faux academic papers about. And it was partly just a way of sort of entering further into the world of Sherlock Holmes, and also sort of a way of making fun of academic or scholarly writing. So it was a sort of a group that would meet really regularly in England that included some famous writers, and then it spread to groups in America and other parts of England besides, I think, London, Oxford was where the original ones were. And there's even some Sherlockian groups in Japan now.
Well, that's interesting. You said that was the original fandom. So are modern-day Star Trek fans and other Star Wars, for that matter, Sherlock Holmes fans kind of paved the way there.
Yes, exactly. In the way that they turned being a fan of Sherlock Holmes into a community, a social group. It's not just a shared taste, but it's actually the foundation for real relationships and a group identity, and the way that they use the stories as a springboard for their own storytelling.
We've got a post here from Libby on Facebook who says, my appreciation of Holmes and Watson grew out of Data and Geordi's repeated holodeck portrayals of them on Star Trek The Next Generation. Just another example of where they've gone, where no one has gone before. Sherlock Holmes has.
Yeah. It's not surprising that that the relationship, the connection between Sherlock Holmes and Star Trek goes back to the original Star Trek, where although the dominance and their relationship is reversed, many people have observed the similarities between Mr. Spock and Sherlock Holmes. Being part of the kind of attraction of the character is that his emotions are supposed to be either non-existent or, you know, comprehensively suppressed. And that is, of course, as the creator of the new series noted, you know, just incredibly sort of provocative to some people who want to imagine that they'd be the one to sort of overcome his aloofness.
We'll leave it there for now. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's really been fun.
That's Laura Miller with Salon.com talking about Sherlock Holmes and her recent piece on Sherlock in Harper's Magazine.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.